Thank you.
She's
I learned something new.
You bet. Ciao.
As always.
I'm going to call this meeting to order, a public hearing for House Bill 2487. I want to welcome everybody. And I would be remiss if, and probably be in trouble with the chair if I didn't ask you and remind you to turn off your cell phones, not just to vibrate, but completely off. And we have two people here that would like to testify for House Bill 2487. They don't necessarily share views or opinions, but do you mind both coming up at the same time? Dennis Johnson and Gary Conkling. Let's see, Gary. Oh, there he is. Thank you. And as you're getting settled in, Kevin, would you give us an overview on 2487, please?
Thank you, Vice Chairwoman. Members of the committee, before you is HB 2487. This is a measure that extends the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program to include qualified graduate students at eligible graduate institutions. It provides that the cost of the education of a qualified graduate student shall be shared by the student, the family of the student, federal government, and state government. They set the parameters in terms of determining the shares with respect to graduate programs, and establishes an order for distribution of grants to students in the event funds are not available to award grants to all students. That's the measure before. And we were previously scheduled this for last Friday, but had to move it over, and I believe these are the two speakers who are coming back to present with respect to the bill.
Thank you. And before you start, if you just please, for the record, state your name.
Certainly. For the record, Dennis Johnson. I'm director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I should say that as a matter of addressing this bill, I have two emotions. First of all, I need to be clear that this is not in the governor's budget. It's clearly an additional proposal that would cost the state funds that we don't have right now. For that reason, of course, we need to be, as a state agency, in opposition to this bill. I need also to tell you, just in the interest of full disclosure, that as a former graduate school vice president, in my heart, I feel these students deserve support as well. You heard some compelling stories last week about graduate students who feel that to gain the credential that they need to advance in their chosen professions, it's like taking a vow of poverty, and that by not having adequate financial aid resources, they're taking on unreasonable amounts of debt. We know that to be true. This, however, is not part of, as I said, the governor's recommended budget right now. It's not in any of our planning right now, so we have to oppose it as a matter of policy at this point. For the future, the statute would give us a lot of flexibility if in some future biennium there would be funding available. We certainly, at the Student Assistance Commission, could make this work. There's no question about that. Of the 400-some other programs that we administer, very few of the private scholarships are available to graduate students. So we're kind of a microcosm of what graduate students encounter. If only a few dozen of our scholarships are available to graduate students as well as undergraduates, then that's kind of what the terrain looks like for a graduate student thinking of going on in his or her chosen profession. So, in my head, of course, I understand. No money, limited resources for the next biennium. We can't afford this. In my heart, I understand those students deserve support as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Conkling, appearing here today on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We're not taking a position for or against this bill, but using it as an opportunity to note that this committee introduced a bill at our request relating to students attending accredited career colleges located in Oregon. So I'm using this as an opportunity opportunity as an advance plug for coming attractions. Since the chair has indicated a willingness to listen to the bill, as my colleague just mentioned, our bill is written in a way that it would not have an impact in the coming biennium. Out of respect for the governor's budget, and I'm sure legislative realities as you deal with the budget problem, it would propose to make those students eligible for an opportunity grant in the subsequent biennium or starting with the academic year of 2011-2012. While we have no objections to extending the opportunity grant to postgraduate degree programs, we think that it's important that this committee consider really looking at equalization of opportunity grants for all undergraduate students at this point. That's important. And just as a final note, to put in a plug for opportunity grants, this is probably the most cost-effective way to ensure access to Oregon post-secondary institutions, regardless which ones students choose. We're very strong supporters of the opportunity grant for the principle of access to all students, and really as a tool that allows all students to exercise choice.
Thank you. Any questions for our panel? Representative Huffman.
Actually, Madam Vice Chair, a comment on both of the programs that have been mentioned. I'm of the opinion that I love the Oregon Opportunity Grant, first of all, and I wish we could fund it to its fullest. And on both of these suggestions, the bill that Gary mentioned we'll see later, I think that they're both fully consistent with the goals as set forth in the Education Committee the last almost 2 years that I've sat on it, and also the Workforce Development, previously the Workforce and Economic Development Committee. We want to skill people up. We want as many diplomas in the state as we can possibly get. We want to increase people's income, get them off of assistance where that's applicable. And I think providing the Oregon Opportunity Grant in these situations is fully consistent with everything that we talk about. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that. Give me just one moment.
I think let's take a recess.
Take a recess.
We can close this session.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2487, and this committee is going to...
It's going to recess.
And then this committee is going to be at recess for I don't know how long. Representative Gelser just got us word that she's going to be a little longer than anticipated, and so out of respect for her, we're just going to hold on for a little bit.
Not a clue. So we are back in session. Thank you, Representative Springer.
You're welcome.
Holding down the fort. We are going to open a work session on House Bill 2599. Colleagues, you'll remember from Monday that House Bill 2599, it's right here, is the bullying and harassment bill that we heard on Monday. We do have a -1 amendment that was distributed on Monday. I know we're going to have a discussion here today, but I wanted to frame for you a little bit. I've had the chance to touch base with most of you about my intentions for today. It's my hope that we will adopt the -1 amendment and move this bill to the floor with the understanding that we will be adding the issue of bullying and harassment to our interim committee work plan. And the idea behind this is I agree that we need to have further discussion about accountability measures related to what happens when there is bullying and harassment in school and the response of schools when students are having these issues, as well as attention to what's going on with the individuals who are committing the bullying and harassment. What are we learning from them, and what kinds of services and supports might they need? And it would be my intention that by passing this bill out, which takes an important first step towards making sure that there is a point person in every district, that we'll be sending that signal to districts that we are deadly serious about this and that we are going to be coming back to talk about accountability. And that's also going to give us the opportunity to see back from districts that they have, in fact, published these policies and identified their point people. So that's my hope for what we'll do today. I know that we're going to have some discussion about that first. I understand there might be some other amendments that people may wish to discuss. And so with that, I would open it up for discussion. Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, I visited with you and another individual. The only question that I have is why we have to list protected class or list people and the categories they're in, whether gay or fat or whatever. I still don't quite get why we don't just say all students, because that covers everybody and they're all on an equal footing, as they should be. Mm-hmm. And I think by specifying and enlisting kids, you know, we're going to be back next year, the year after, adding people that we left off or whatever. And I guess I just don't see the point why we can't just say all students to make it a level playing field.
Thanks, and I appreciate that. I think that the intention of the bill clearly is that it does encompass all students. The amendment that we have, that -1, adds some language, the including but not limited to. I think the idea of listing out those characteristics, unfortunately, some of those groups in that list aren't always included when people say everyone and all. And I think certainly there's been discussion in this group about sexual orientation and how districts, you know, different communities may feel have different perspectives on that issue and therefore may not be offering those students the protection they need. I know certainly for students with disabilities, sometimes that bullying or harassment that comes, the response might be, well, that's just what kids do when they see someone that's that different. It makes it clear that really we mean everyone, and I think that including but not limited to sets that floor and gives that indication that we really do mean everyone.
I just had to get on the record.
Thanks. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, and I didn't set Representative Huffman up to say that, I have a -3 amendment that I would like to introduce for your consideration, and there's a lot of words here, most of which realigns subsections, but I too share that concern. As I looked at this bullying bill, and make no mistake, I'm adamantly on any level for any reason opposed to bullying, and if my guy was the target of such bullying, I can guarantee you this mama bear would be pretty cranky and would not be apologetic for that. That said, language has been placed in lines 20 through 21, 23 that talk about the protected class and delineates several classifications there. But then in line 20, the amendment that was just referenced, the dash one, comes back and looks at that language and says, but is not limited to or includes. I think it also adds the word include, but not limited to. And so that causes the question to arise in my mind. We're adding language that now we need to back up and qualify. So why do we need to add the language in the first place? And I see this bill as being a bill about behavior of a person who's doing the bullying, not the person who's being bullied and who they are or may not be or how they look or whatever. And so I think to keep the emphasis on the behavior, which is what we're attacking here, that's why I introduced these dash threes. This keeps the conversation focused on the behavior of the bullying and not the status of the bullied, I guess. And so I would introduce that for your consideration.
Representative Maurer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, in fact, even with the dash ones, the bill is still permissive in what you're going to protect. I mean, it may be based on the protected class. So if you are inclined to not acknowledge sexual orientation as a protected class, then this law would protect you from not including that in your district's policy or in a school policy or in what you see. So I just think the permissive language is really a wide open door that does not really get to where I think most people want to be.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, did I see you?
Yeah, actually, thank you. I heard you talking about making sure we get a point person there, and I don't have a problem with that. But I'm concerned that we're not talking about all the issues that have been brought up from constituents to my office, and I'm sure others here. Why don't we just make sure we appoint that point person, make sure the school districts have a point person, and then deal with the rest of these issues and thoroughly vet it during the interim? That would be sending a message that we're serious about this. He brought up an issue. I have an issue about the term that I have yet to find any definition that says something other than subjective or nebulous when it comes to a definition for psychological well-being. And I just wonder if we would inadvertently open up a can of worms by either not defining that or just leaving it in there as it is. Those are just some concerns that I have. So,
thank you. I appreciate that. And I think that what this bill really does, it has two pieces. It directs the districts to have these policies, to have these minimum standards, and publish them and include that point person. And I think without the published policies, it's very difficult for the students to take advantage of that, even with a point person. But I know a number of folks have been asking about that psychological well-being, and I had asked for some information about that and received some while I was upstairs testifying in another committee, so I haven't read this all the way yet, but I'm sharing it with you. But it basically says, House Bill 2599 further clarifies hostile educational environment with the term psychological well-being. These terms are considered legal terms of art that were taken right out of hostile work environment cases under Title VII and put into the Model Safe Schools legislation in several other states. And because of that, there are existing cases where the standard has been made clear and demonstrates that the term is not vague. There should be no concern that this will open up districts to frivolous claims. Also, because it comes from employment case law originally, the standard is much higher than you think at first glance. And so this comes from the coalition that's supporting the bill, and it appears to include a series of references from prior case law. Representative Dimbrough.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the dash one amendment. and then I'd be prepared to speak on it. Okay. Is this a time to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 3rd, 2009.
Representative Dimbrough moves the Dash 1 amendment dated
March 3rd
of 2009. And you wanted to speak
yes,
to that
thank
also.
You.
We'll continue
thank
the discussion. There's still a number of people in the queue.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to speak to the issue of calling out the protected classes, which I believe, you know, is a very important component of this bill, and this is why I believe that. First of all, you know, I think all bullying of all kinds is wrong and should be discouraged as quickly as possible. But there is a special kind of bullying, I believe, when it's directed against children who belong to these protected classes, and it tends to be more. I referred the other day to, you know, I used the term mobbing, you know, where there's a kind of grouping directed against somebody who's in a minority of some sort. I have to say, I myself have had experience with that. It is very, very painful and difficult, and it's different from the kind of bullying that happens when somebody who is bigger than somebody else and is bullying them. And I think that if you look at the people who are in these groups that are called out as part of protected classes, you can easily, you know, I think you can all see how that happens and is very, very injurious. And so I think it is important to call that out here because I think it's really important for schools to be very proactive in seeing this kind of thing as it's developing and to set up an atmosphere where this kind of thing will not happen. And that's why I fully support this Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Maurer, I thought I heard you trying to get back in the queue.
Madam Chair, I did, but it was not on the Dash 1.
All right. So I'll come back to you later. Okay. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I've been sitting here thinking about it, and I'm thinking about all students, as Representative Huffman talked about, and that's what we really want. But in terms of a protected class, I'm one of those people too. And when I think about it, I wonder if I didn't have a disability as a child, would they still have picked on me? I don't know. But I do know that they did. And consequently, I'm thinking that by leaving this in the law or the statute, that it really points out that this is a problem, and that we recognize it and we want it addressed, because I do believe that it is minimized, it is not taken seriously in many cases, and I just feel that, especially obviously, I feel very strongly about kids with disabilities, because that's what I'm familiar with. But I just feel that we still need to create an environment that is inclusive of all children, and we need to make statements like this so that people do become aware that we all are created equal.
Thank you, Representative. Is there further discussion? On the Dash 1, is there further discussion on Representative Springer? You're right on my list. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would pose the question, and then I'll move from this point. If we are, and I'm pretty confident that everybody at this dais right now supports this bill in some fashion as far as saying no to bullying. But if indeed it is our goal to not separate out people and to not draw a distinction, and we're talking about drawing a distinction here, we've added language that draws a distinction. And so in that language, are we setting up, and I do not mean this facetiously, are we setting up more protected, less protected? I mean, I'm going to be as cranky if my guy, I guess it could be a disability because he wears glasses, if my guy got picked on in school for wearing glasses or goofy hair or goofy ears or goofy whatever, it is just as damaging and is just as important. So if we really don't want to draw distinctions, we've drawn distinctions.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Breslin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having worked in education settings my entire life, I think the thing that I like about the amendment is that for years and years, we have used terms indiscriminately amongst our citizens, which caused a lot of harm and injury to people without even knowing it happened. And so I talk about, with my disability people, the word we use is, that's lame. Well, where did that come from? That came from the kid that was limping around a long time ago. But we don't go back and think about that. We say that's gay, which in the 1880s wasn't a big word at all. In fact, we have people come back and say the gay 90s and whatever. But today, the way it's sent and the way it's used, not even if it's not bullying, it just becomes the part of the vernacular of the age groups in middle school and other times. And until we clearly put into the brains of the teachers and other people that we have to change those languages, that even if they're not trying to bully people, that it is hurting people in those environments, that they don't even know they're hurting. And it is only when we point that out to us who have been living in the environment for a long time, that we identify it and change our behaviors, that we stop the other kids from giving them permission, tacit permission, to use those same languages. And if we don't start setting that place that in the line in the sand that says we're not going past this line anymore, we can't do this to kids and to others in our society just because we didn't intend it. I mean, that's something that you have to draw out. And I think that for that reason alone, there are times when you have to stand back and look at it and say, what are we really trying to do? We're trying to stop all bullying. And was I bullied? Yes, I was. I was a dyslexic, hyperactive kid who didn't do well in school, and it was difficult at different times. And then I grew bigger, and I could have used that to be the biggest kid in the class, and they didn't bully me as much, you know? And in fact, when I will tell you that one of the greatest experiences for me, I go into middle school. Before middle school, school was really hard. I didn't do very well. I get into middle school, and I'm in the lowest level classes in the middle school, and I can't figure out why I'm there, because I thought I was like those other kids. I was another friend. And I find all these other people teasing all these kids that I'm with in this class. The smart ones are just picking on them. And by the end of the 7th and 8th grade, I moved to advanced classes. And so here all these kids were scared to death of the kids that I used to be friends with down here, because they're going to beat them up now, because they've been teasing them for 2 years. And I became this mediator person that said, you know, those guys down there, they're really pretty good kids in this class, and those kids up there in this class, they're pretty good too. They're just different. Everybody in middle school tries to find out what's different about everybody, because everybody wants to be the same. And until people realize that it is the adults in these situations that have a responsibility to stop all of those behaviors, that each of us, God put us on here for a reason on this planet, and we all have value, and we all have a purpose in this world. We aren't going to have the kind of world I would like to have all schools become. And we worked on this diligently at the schools that I worked in trying to get people to not use language. And people called it, you know, PC. It drives me crazy. It wasn't politically correct. It was the right thing to do. I mean, that you don't need to use those languages until you get, you know, for me, reading was difficult and a lot of other kinds of things. But when I finally got there, I thought, I should know how to use the language correctly. So I've worked on that. And it shouldn't be about PC this or PC that. It should be about appropriate language that expresses your beliefs and your feelings to somebody else so they can understand them and communicate it back. And I look at this bill as one more attempt for us as a society to get it right, to treat people the way we were all asked to be treated. In every good book I've read, whether it's the Bible or others, it's about treating people the way you want to be treated. And to point out things where we as a society have wavered at different times, I think is important for us to get back on the track that we're trying to do this for all people. So, for me, great opportunity to show that.
Sorry, got on my, this one is one that's personal to me.
Thank you. And I think it's important to clarify, I think some of the language that we heard the other day talked about how when you had strong bullying and anti-harassment policies in schools, it works and it increases the use of respectful language. This bill, of course, wouldn't define the use of any of those words themselves as bullying. It still would need to threaten harm to the individual. Not that I'm promoting the use of those words. I think for me, the one that gets me is the word retard, which gets used all over the place. And that really gets my blood boiling. However, it certainly wouldn't, this bill would not define someone that used the word retard on the playground as someone that was a bully unless they were threatening someone. Is there further discussion either on the dash one or on the, just a second.
I think the dash one is the amendment we need to consider right now.
Right. No, I understand the dash one is the amendment that we're considering. I also understand that it's, if you wish to make comments generally to the bill, I am still open to that at this point, knowing that there are other amendments out there that might be, and that discussion might influence your vote on this particular motion. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the Dash 1 amendment is really critical. I have a problem with restricting it to a defined class here. I have been the only white kid in large groups of black kids in various places in New York and the East Coast and elsewhere. I lived in Mexico for 3 years as a kid, and I was many, many, many times the only non-Mexican kid on the soccer field. I have had very little input from constituents. The only input I have had is from someone who is a member of a protected class who said that language should not be in there. I do believe, or following subsequent conversation with this individual, I believe that the Dash 1 amendment takes care of the impression that it is limited to the members of the protected class. If we were limiting it to the members of the protected class, I would have a very different feeling about this bill, and I did until the amendment was put forth on Monday. With Dash 1 in there, I'm in support of the Dash 1 amendment, and it's something I've agonized over a fair amount. I agree completely with what you said, Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huffman.
And I do want to say I would like to, I still like the language of all students, but I am supportive of Dash 1 because, like Representative Harker said, it gets me to the point where it doesn't focus on protected class, and it does, it's more inclusive.
Thank you.
I guess I should have continued my thought on that.
Thank you. And, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about this protected class language, many of us have had discussions about it, and the protected class language kind of talks about the motivation, and so that even in this one, as an only white child in a situation where you're with folks who are of different races, you would still be protected under that because it doesn't specify a skin color that's protected. It's race generally. Yep. So I believe that in almost every circumstance, almost any child or any person could fall under any of these items that are stated there. But I think that including but not limited to language is important. Mm-hmm. And also in the amendment, it's also that associated with or perceived to be is that language that's there as well, which is important for the brother or sister of the developmentally disabled child, or it just extends out in so many ways. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I couldn't help but think about raw cookie dough. I love raw cookie dough, and I just think this bill is a little bit of a raw cookie dough. It's just not baked yet, and if you partook of it, maybe the eggs have salmonella. I don't know. There might be some things, and there's just too many unanswered questions, and it just needs to be baked a little bit before I can support it, and I will be a no for now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Is there any further discussion before we take our vote on the Dash 1 amendment? No. Seeing none, Debbie, would you call the roll on the Dash 1 amendment, please?
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Conk?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dembrough?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
And Chair Gilzer?
Aye. Having received the majority of votes, so ordered. Is there further discussion on this bill before we, Representative Mowers?
Yes, Madam Chair. In front of you are Dash 2 amendments. And the Dash 2 amendments would create a civil penalty for failure to report, essentially. At least that's what I thought they were supposed to say. I am not going to ask that we fully consider that amendment because you are going to do an interim work group. The concern I have is that the accountability lies with school districts that do not comply and would be considered non-standard, which means that the school district may be held financially responsible ultimately for failing to comply with this law. And I haven't asked very deeply. I said, has the school district been held non-standard and had to pay money back? And the short answer was no, but that may not be correct. I'm not going to suggest that I have all the answers. My concern is that at some point, you know, we heard many of the stories here. You know, the testimony was, I'm sorry, beyond bullying. In fact, some of it was criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. And in fact, should have been reported to authorities, and it wasn't. And I didn't hear anything about any sort of disciplinary action taken toward the people that failed to report. In fact, it would have been, as mandatory reporters, they should have reported child abuse. And I'm not sure that this law, of course, doesn't address that piece of it. I had it drafted up because my concern clearly was we need to work on this accountability issue. And at some point, we apply civil penalties to many classes of people, child care workers and the like. And currently there are no civil penalties for actions taken by teachers. So I would just ask that this issue of accountability be addressed during the interim. And that, you know, although civil penalty isn't necessarily the right way to go, I just had to bring up the topic.
Thank you, Representative Mauer. Representative Springer.
Oh, thank you. I must be in the queue. You have in front of you a Dash 3 amendment, and I think I spoke to this briefly earlier. And what this amendment does, it's a long amendment, and basically that's a remuneration, basically. But I just still have concerns. I guess I'm to the point, I'm so committed to a bullying bill and stopping it that I want to make sure nobody is left out of the loop and that we, again, aren't labeling. And so this amendment deletes lines that I referenced before, 20, 21 and through 23, and then there's a subsequent section on the back. I believe it is lines 1 and 2 on page 2, line 4, and the rest of those are delineated out there for you. And again, I won't beat a dead horse and move on. I just think it's important that we don't segment people out when we're trying to be inclusive. And so I don't know if... I don't know. I don't have a fiscal. I couldn't get the fiscal back in time. If I can introduce it without that fiscal, I'd like to do
so
that.
So would you like to move the dash? Mm-hmm. This is the dash 3.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd make a motion to adopt the dash 3 amendment.
So Representative Springer moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments. Is there further discussion on the dash 3 amendments?
Well...
Representative Van Orman?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair Gelser. I'm sorry. I'm obviously stewing about this bill, as I have been for a few days, and I've been stewing about it
sort of along the lines of Representative Maurer. And what I concluded was that based on what we heard yesterday, and I know there's always two sides to the story, is I heard aiding and abetting child abuse. I did hear that. And I thought, well, the thing that I really believe is that if school districts are really going to protect themselves from any kind of liability, any kind of a fee, that the permissive language in line 20 on dash 3, which says are encouraged to incorporate into existing programs, I think that a word to the wise is that they might not want to be encouraged, they might want to do it. And because some of the things I heard yesterday, or Monday, it seemed like yesterday, really does make me wonder about the protection of children and whether or not school districts are acting in good faith to get on top of this problem and not sweeping it under the rug. So I'm haunted by some of the stories.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman. Representative Springer, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, and I agree. In the dash 3 line, on line 20 and 21 of the dash 3, it does talk about encouraged, and as Representative Roblin just mentioned to me, that was a fiscal issue, but that's also on the dash 1.
Right.
So it's not just the dash 3 that does that. The dash 1's already done that.
Which, of course,
my dash 3 just captured the language that we just adopted.
Yes. So, yeah, so it would be, my statement would be about both, and you're right. I did pass the other. I did vote for the other.
Thank you, Representative
Chair, just, you know, I fully agree, even though it's, you know, we've already passed this in the dash 1, you know, I fully agree with Representative Van Orman. I would hope that this would be part of the discussion of the interim group. You know, how to get us from encouragement to mandatory on this, so we can get these training programs throughout the state.
Representative Roblin.
To speak to the ones that, and the one that was not introduced, because I think I too am uptight about the fact that there aren't these penalties. I don't think the civil penalty is the right route, and I appreciate not having that in. But I do think that while we're here and we have the bully pulpit, we can say to people that represent, like, school boards, associations, and others, that when they start writing recommended rules, that they are pretty clear about different ways that they could attack the teachers about, if you don't report this, something's going to go in your file. I mean, do something so that people know that they have a responsibility to that. And from my perspective, when school districts like the one we saw last time when they talked about the Eugene School District and some others, they do have some pretty specific things in there about how to go about doing some things and letting people know we aren't going to tolerate it. Because I still believe we have a number of school districts. They are independent units. And one of the things that we get here and up here is we want to resolve everything for them and tell them what to do. And when it comes to some things, they don't really want us to tell us, and other things they may like us to tell us. But the reality is we have to hold them responsible, because that's why we do this. We're going to stop their funding. That's the tool we have to tell them that this is really important, and we'd really like you to put rules in place in your school districts that make sure this stuff happens. And I believe the Dash Ones give them that responsibility. And then I think the work group will give us a chance to see, did they take the responsibility seriously or not? Because I would like them to resolve this themselves. I think that local districts, figuring out how they're going to do it in their local district is a really good thing. But if they don't, then they need to understand that clearly we've sent them a message. It's time. This is an area we're going to come in on. Because I agree, hearing the stories, and every one of us reliving our own experiences at different times, know that this is a real issue that needs to be taken care of. But I still, my original statement stands about why I think those other classes need to be in there in the first place, and that's why I could not support the dash
3.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the dash 3? Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair. And I just appreciate everybody's commitment to this issue. Obviously, and we started out with testimony about the Thurston incident with Kip Kinkle. and how when somebody's bullied to the point that they become violent, you don't want that to happen. Many, many, many schools in our state after that incident happened said, we're not going to let this happen in our school. And so they were very proactive in instituting policies for themselves, but not all schools did that. And I just appreciate people wanting to bring these forward, and I will not be supporting the Dash 3s because I really support the concept of moving forward with a work group to see if we did what we need to do, if we need to do it better yet. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. And right after the point that I raised my finger to speak, Representative Comp said everything I was going to say right there about I support the Dash 1s, but with the caveat that I definitely encourage the work group to address everything that the may and shall part, the encourage versus all of that stuff that's been said.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the Dash 3s? No, Debbie, could you call the roll on the Dash 3 amendments? And to clarify, the Dash 3 amendments are similar to the Dash 1s, but it would remove the protected class language.
Yes.
Basically. Great. Thank you.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Comp?
No.
Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative Roblin?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Representative Van Orman?
No.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
No.
Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
And Chair Gelser?
No. The motion is not, it fails, is not successful. Is there further discussion on House Bill 2599? Representative Thatcher.
When do you intend to appoint a work group? I do fully support hashing this out and baking the cookies a little long. I think I'm hungry.
Are you hungry?
Representative Roblin.
Hey. Okay. No throwing food in the committee. That's a different bill. Junk food.
We
no
already
less.
Did that one.
So in terms of the work group, we will. I assume we're going to have time to start discussing this again after we pass our chamber deadline before we leave in this committee, and then we'll be moving that forward to a work group probably later in the session and over into the interim. But I do expect we'll bring this back for at least one discussion before we adjourn this session, but it will be on our interim work plan.
Okay, good. I think it's important. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you. You make me want to go home and get cookies. Sounds like a good activity. Is there further discussion on this bill?
We've got to figure that one out.
Nope.
Good.
Are there any motions?
Yes.
I was a little. It depends on the type of cookie dough. I guess we never. It could make a difference, and we never clarified that.
Okay,
I'll.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'll stand.
No, he needs no more sugar.
We'll need a clear calorie.
Peanut butter.
And you might be allergic. Too many have an unnatural obsession with cookies and junk food. And it's the 1 o'clock committee. We all should have eaten before we've. All right, Representative Dimbro, do you have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does it involve cookies?
It does not, Madam Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I move House Bill 2599 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Huffman moves House Bill 25. Representative Dimbro moves House Bill 2599 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion about this bill or any baked goods? No, seeing none. Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gelzer?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the bill passes to the floor as amended. And Representative Huffman, would you carry this bill for us?
I would love to.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2599 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2108. Kevin, would you give us a brief overview of House Bill 2108?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2108. In substance, the bill before you, the 2108, requires schools to confer and take steps with respect to career colleges. It is worth noting that prior to the meeting late this morning, a Dash 2 amendment was brought forward that, as I understand from speaking with the Department of Education, conceptually is similar to the bill. However, there are some reworking of the language. Again, deals in large part with the substance of the bill in terms of safeguarding students enrolled in career school programs and also devising clear regulation authority. Again, the Dash 2 amendment is a wholesale gotten stuff of the language that is currently found in the bill, and I understand that there's a representative from the Department of Education who will be speaking to the specific changes from the original bill to the Dash 2. We do not have the fiscal impact with respect to the Dash 1, rather the Dash 2, or the underlying bill.
Great. Thank you. And colleagues, I know that this is noted for a public hearing and possible work session. It is not my intention to work this bill today. I know that's a pretty substantive amendment change that you have before you. And who is here from? There he is. So Morgan Allen and Green? Teresa Green. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I may, we also have, although this is not the fiscal office sanctioned fiscal, there is before each of you at the dais an agency fiscal impact statement form with respect to the Dash 2 that was also provided with the Department of Education as well.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and joining me today is Teresa Green, who oversees our work with private career schools, and as the committee administrator described, we are gutting and stuffing our own bill to get some correct language in there. I just want to compliment Legislative Council. They really helped us turn this around quickly so that we can get it here for the committee today. So let me give you a little bit of background. The Private Career School Office at the Department of Education, we license private career schools and provide leadership and assistance and training to almost 300 of these schools in Oregon. So some of them are things you'd expect, places where you would go to learn about computer technology, schools of cosmetology, healthcare, real estate schools, business programs. But yes, it is true, we also license tattoo schools and truck driving schools and cooking schools, so it's a very broad field. Don't ask me to explain how the Department of Education, we generally do pre-K through 12 education, and obviously these are post-secondary programs, so I don't know how we ended up with it, but it is housed in our department, and we're charged with taking care of these places. And I think several of you have heard from a lot of these folks before. These programs provide a lot of opportunities for students who are very career-focused. Generally, the typical student is post-high school. They may already have some sort of career or be seeking a new career, and we want to make sure that the schools have minimum levels of standards to ensure that these students are prepared for productive careers. One clear thing we need to talk about, and this is sort of part of the reason the bill is brought forward, is the private career schools that we license, they don't offer an associate's degree like a community college or a bachelor's degree. So it's not like ITT Tech. I mean, these are really certificate programs or programs where you're gaining a specific trade or a skill. And it's really, it's a fast-changing and ever-expanding part of post-secondary education in Oregon. We have lots of schools opening every year, and again, we have about 300 of these. So.
And I think there's a question from Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan, can you repeat the last two sentences? Something, I thought I was tracking, and then you said something about these are schools that do not confer
associates or... Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, we were actually in the hearing the other day when you heard from ITT Tech and like the Art Institute of Portland, and those schools oftentimes offer associate's degree. Representative Dembro was in there as well. They offer associate's degrees or bachelor's degrees. Those schools, I believe, are regulated by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission Office of Degree Authorization. And so these schools essentially, they offer a vocational certificate or training, or if you're going to go to school to be a barber to help you get your licensure, through the Board of Cosmetology or something like that. So they're very specific in career real estate license schools would be something that we would regulate. So
thank you.
So now I'm going to talk about the amendment, Section 2 of the amendment. So as I said earlier, these private career schools that we license, they don't offer an AA or a BA. But in some instances, some of these private career schools decide to change their focus, and they may want to start offering an associate's degree program or a bachelor's degree program. And in that instance, then their program must be approved by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission Office of Degree Authorization. So once OSAC begins this process of reviewing them to, offer those programs, they'll eventually review all of their other non-degree granting programs that the school has to continue to offer. But right now, there's not clear statutory authority as to who should be regulating those non-degree programs during this period when they're getting approval by the Student Assistance Commission and working to get their programs approved. So Section 2 of the amendment, what we're trying to do is make it very clear that until the Oregon Student Assistance Commission has reviewed and approved all the courses of programs, both degree granting and non-degree granting, that the school must continue to be registered as a licensed private career school as long as there are still students enrolled in the school, the non-degree programs that started before the school decided to change over. So I know that sounds confusing, but let's say I start at a barber school and I'm going to get my 6-month certificate to become a barber, and my barber school wants to start offering associate's degrees in barbering.
We're all okay.
I don't have a lot to say about her, but then they would, to get that AA degree, they go to the Office of Degree Authorization. But I started before the AA program, and let's say I'm almost done with that program. We want to make it very clear. There's sort of this limbo period or this transition period where OSAC isn't really in charge of that program, and the department doesn't have clear authority to protect those students in case something changes in the program. And so what we're trying to do and put in statute is say, until the entirety of the programs are approved by OSAC, we still have authority over those students.
Morgan, I think Representative Roblin has a question.
On that point, I think some people don't realize that process that OSAC goes through could take a year, 2 years. That takes a while, correct? And that's the period of time we're talking about.
I believe that's correct, and actually Mr. Contreras is here to testify as well, too, and hopefully, and I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
But it's not a short time period that we're talking about.
Right.
So, Chair Gelser, the reason we want to do this is because it does two important things. First, it allows those students that are still enrolled in those non-degree granting programs to be protected from potential bad actors, and frankly, sometimes this is an area where, for lack of a better term, we've had some fly-by-night schools. If you know Debbie Koreski in the speaker's office, she could recite chapter and verse her experience working at one of these bad actor schools and the things that happen. So when they're under our licensing authority, they're still eligible for a tuition protection fund. So if they show up Friday and they're taking classes and they pay their tuition and then suddenly the school's gone on Monday, they're protected. And then the second reason, again, we just want to give some clear statutory authority to the department to, during this sort of limbo phase or this bridge phase or this transition phase. So that's one part of the bill. The second part of the bill, and now I'm on page 2 of my testimony, so I want to talk about Section 4 of the Dash 2 Amendment very briefly. So what we want to do, this section is intended to give the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the Department the authority to consider prior history by someone who wants to open a private career school in Oregon. And again, as I just said, there have been some unfortunate examples of bad actors and sort of fly-by-night people setting up shop in Oregon, defrauding students, taking advantage of people. And so what we want to do with the amendment is give some clear authority to deny a license to a school operator who demonstrates a history of inappropriate behavior. And what do I mean by inappropriate behavior? Specifically, the amendment would allow us to look at conduct that may have caused their private career school to be put on probation, suspended, or have their license revoked in Oregon or in other states. So if someone wants to open up a private career school in Oregon and we do a little research and find out maybe they had a chain of private career schools in Montana that ended under some poor circumstances, and maybe there were some criminal charges, students were defrauded, it would give us some authority to say, well, you can't set up shop here in Oregon now that Montana's kicked you out of their state. Failure to comply with career school rules and
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the superintendent does not have authority now to look at prior history?
We do have some authority to sort of, for lack of a better term, I think maybe moral fitness or character, but we want to get some specific statutory authority that would allow us to deny a license if we found out they had engaged in bad acting, for lack of a better term. So we're trying to strengthen that language.
Thank you.
So again, so if any of these areas I just discussed, you know, history of operation in another state, revocation of license, any of those things, red flags pop up, it gives us some more authority to say, nope, you can't have a license here in Oregon. So the other thing that we want to talk about that's in Section 4, and this has sort of arisen over time, and frankly, this part of the bill has been informed by the discussion that this committee and the Senate Education Committee have had about protecting minor students. So a lot of, well, not a lot, but some private career schools actually offer programs and enroll minor students under the age of 18. Most of them do a great job. We don't have any problems with that. But what we don't have right now is what we're seeking is the authority to do criminal background checks and fingerprint the owners, operators, agents, or instructors of private career schools who open their doors to students under 18. So if you're I'll just go back to my barber college example. So if you're a barber college and you enroll, you know, a 16-year-old, then what we are going to say is that you need to submit your employees and your owner and your operator to criminal background checks. And our intention is through the rulemaking process, what we want to do is mirror the things that would prohibit you from being a public school teacher in Oregon or prohibit you from being a bus driver or a classified employee in Oregon. We want to look at those set of statutes and say, you cannot work at a private career school. You cannot own or operate a private career school if you've been convicted of one of these crimes.
And the question is, Springer has a question.
That's a great point, Morgan. So would every single employee of one of these schools be required to do a criminal background check, or would it be unsupervised contact? Delineate that out.
Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, our intention is that if a school wants to allow enrollment of minor students, that we would do a FBI fingerprint background check of all of their employees. So, again...
I'm sorry, Representative Van Orman.
So, as you do already.
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, we do not currently have authority to fingerprint...
No, but you already do it for other groups.
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, that's right. The Teachers and Standards Practices Commission does the fingerprinting checks for teachers and licensed counselors and a few nurses and other folks. We do all the classified employees, so teacher assistants, bus drivers, custodial staff. So we already have that sort of system built into our agency. Thank you guys for bearing with me. I know this is, you're like, why is he here talking private career schools? What are they doing over at the department with private career schools?
Representative Maurer.
I would agree. My question is, what's the problem? I mean, where's, you know, the bullying bill? They're out the door. Where's the problem?
Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, I'm going to turn to my colleague in case we have any specific examples. Maybe let her start, and then I can sort of fill in from there. So have any issues with the minor students?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, to date, I am not aware that we have had any specific problems. However, we want to be proactive.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Teresa Green. I oversee the Private Career Schools Unit in the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation at the Department of Education.
Next and Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, just to be perfectly frank with you, what we want to avoid, we don't have any real specific examples where we could say we know something terrible happened, but we do know, for example, a type of private career school that we might license might be a modeling school or something like that, and we want to make sure that if there are minor children enrolled there, that the instructors and people working around those children have a clean background check, just like we would expect in any public school in Oregon. Since we're licensing these schools, we feel like we have an obligation to protect those kids.
Okay. Okay. Madam Chair, I see the nexus here, and okay. Actually, that answers all my questions. I mean, I thought you were expanding your role. One of the complaints that I have is we tend to be very reactionary and we're never proactive and trying to figure things out. And the fact that you license these schools now, I think I can now draw that.
And Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, I think there are representatives of private career schools here, and I've talked to some of the lobby that represent some of these schools, and I have heard none of the schools object to the fingerprinting provisions. As a matter of fact, I think they all support it. This is an industry where the people that are in this business, they want it to be reputable, they want to prevent bad actors, they want to prevent the rare sort of fly-by-night operator that comes in because they want their institutions to be credible and have a good product to market to the public. So, again, what we're trying to do, again, just there are a few other technical changes in there as well in Section 4. And then Section 5 of the amendments just deals with granting the superintendent the authority to charge a fee for those criminal background checks. I believe, and what we would do is we would limit the fees to the actual cost of the background checks. I believe, like for a LEDS checks, it's $5. For the full FBI fingerprint background check, it's about $60. One thing I do want to mention is I talked to one of the lobbyists who represents cosmetology schools, and we may need to work on the amendment a little bit further. As you can see, there's a lot of things in there that look intimidating. One of the things that I don't think that we want to do, or what we are not intending to do, is these private career schools get relicensed every year. And so what we don't want to do is say every single year your employees have to get fingerprinted and your owners and operators and agents have to get fingerprinted. And I think the bill might be written in that way, and that was not our intention. So we might need to get it amended a little bit further. Our intention would be, just like with our public school teachers or when we're looking at licensees for the schools, you know, the initial fingerprint background check we think is sufficient. So it's not our intention to basically be fingerprinting the employees or instructors at these schools every single year. So I've committed to those folks that will look at that language, and I'll check with Cindy Hutt and make sure that was not our intention, but it looks like that may have came out in the wash that way, and so we'll try to fix that. And with that, Chair Gelser, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any further questions, Representative Van Orman?
Back to the criminal history check. In the employment division, it's for the criminal history registry. For them, it's I think you have to do it every 3 years. Do you have something like that, or do you do it once? And
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, I can speak to the types of checks that we do right now. They are on hiring. So if a classified employee were to apply for a job in a school district, say a school bus driver, we would do the finger print background check when they applied to work in a school district. But you know, for custodial staff and a lot of other classified employees, there's not a regular schedule, not every 5 years or every 3 years or every 10 years that they renew that. So
follow up. And I know that when the rule about the more expensive one, the FBI check, which is now $60, that was, you only needed that if you had not lived in the state for the past 3 years. Do you have that same kind of rule?
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, it doesn't specifically talk about that issue in the bill, and it is our intention in the rulemaking process that upon application for relicense, that if you do have minor students, and again, this is a very, I would say it's probably a minority of the schools that actually enroll students under the age of 18, that upon your license renewal, that you would have to submit your employees to a fingerprint check, and then once they've passed that, they're okay, and then what we would do is we would want to continue to just fingerprint new employees. So as a new instructor was hired, we would want to make sure that they meet the same types of standards that one would have to meet to become a school teacher or a school bus driver in Oregon. So again, just it's a minority of the roughly 300 schools that would enroll minors.
Well, just for the record, as a Head Start director, I had to do it too.
Thank you. Are there any final questions for this panel? Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
And next I have Alan Contreras and Kathy McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. Morgan did a fantastic job of setting forth the basic situation we're trying to fix. I wanted to add one or two details that go somewhat to what Representative Roblin was talking about. The reason why this limbo period occurs is that when a school makes a transition from being a certificate or diploma granting career school to being a degree granter, A, they switch agencies from the Department of Education, which currently has authority over the career schools, to the Office of Degree Authorization, which is a part of the Student Assistance Commission. Because of the way the laws of the agencies are written, particularly that of the Department of Ed, the moment that my office approves a degree program at that school, the Department of Ed automatically loses jurisdiction over every single thing that school does. And as Representative Roblin pointed out, we don't approve a school and instantly approve everything it does. We approve program by program. So what happens is we approve an associate degree program, which may take a couple of months depending on how thorough the application was originally. But then that school is submitting to us each of their certificate programs for approval separately because they all have sometimes a different faculty, they have different standards, and so on. It's that gap period during which the Department of Ed has lost its jurisdiction, but when the school is still operating and still has students, we are trying to fill in that gap period, and the time can be anywhere from 2 months to 4, 5, 6 months. Depends a little bit on our staff workload and a little bit on how well prepared the application was to start with. That is the gap we are trying to fill. The issue with the original bill, and I'm speaking only today to Section 2 of the bill. That's the only section that really affects what my office does. The original bill dealt with that problem, but it did so in such a way that any entity that issued a certificate or diploma would belong to the Department of Ed forever. In other words, they would never make the transition over, but they would also still belong to my office, which meant that they would be going through a duplicate application period with two state agencies, two sets of fees, and standards that are not the same. And it struck us that that was a crazy way of doing business. And so what we're trying to do here with the amendment is to set up this transition period during which they do still fall under the protective rules of the Department of Ed until all of their programs are approved by our office. So that is basically where we fit in here. I don't have anything to say about other aspects of the bill. It's that section that affects us, and we're just trying to make sure that things work as efficiently as we can get. Some of you I know are not that familiar with what we do. I've just sent around the little fact sheet that comes out of the agency fact book. Kind of explains that we do all the degree-granting institutions except for the major publics and the longtime privates, where the Department of Ed does the certificate schools. And finally, Madam Chair, I happen to have with me one snickerdoodle, which if Representative Thatcher would, if the Ethics Commission would permit me to leave this for Representative Thatcher today, I would be more than happy to do so. There it is, ma'am.
And it's baked, right?
Huh?
And it's
this
fully
is really
baked,
good.
Right?
I had more of these last night than my doctor permits me to have.
I'm pretty sure that if you read Senate Bill 10 very closely, there is a clause in there that specifically allows snickerdoodles for Representative
really?
Thatcher.
I thought I had seen it somewhere. Madam Chair, I just couldn't remember the details. I do appreciate you calling that to my attention. The Office of Degree Authorization is a state agency, and you can come to us anytime. And I don't really have anything. I'd be glad to answer questions about where we fit into this, this picture, but that's the basics.
Let's let Kathy McDonald go first, and then we'll hold questions till the end of the panel.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy McDonald, and I do represent the Northwest Career College Federation. In a week or so, you will be hearing from representatives from the career schools on another bill, and Representative Thatcher, I will make sure that the culinary school will provide cookies because they will be in a baking session. So I will take that comments on what your favorite, peanut butter, I think, is what I heard earlier.
Hey, you know.
So any cookies, maybe a variety of all that they do because they're amazing. So the Northwest Career Colleges Federation appreciates the work of the Department of Education in regulating private career schools that offer certificates of completion, and we are generally supportive of the changes proposed in House Bill 2108. We do, however, have some concerns with a few of the proposed amendments. The amendments came in while I was driving the Terwilliger curves, and I heard it pop in. I did not read them, and I have briefly gone through them. So I would appreciate the indulgence of the chair to work with Teresa Green. We do have a couple of concerns that we have found that we'd like to address at a more appropriate time than me driving. And then specifically, my comments were drafted to the original bill, and I think Mr. Contreras has talked about some in Section 2 that we were a little concerned about, where it requires that a school that has both degree and certificate programs be required to be approved, both the DOE and the Office of Degree Authorization. We believe this is unnecessary, and we suggest that the bill be amended to provide that during the transition and approval of all programs from DOE to ODA, the school be required to continue its DOE licensing until such time as during the transition period from being in a program that is not approved or licensed by any state agency. Further, we suggest that the same students that are enrolled in a certificate program at the time program authorization transfers to ODA continue to be covered by tuition protection fund until such time as the student either graduates or ceases enrollment, and that the school with those programs continues its contributions to the fund until all affected students are no longer attending. In Section 4.2, it states that the superintendent may exempt from licensing a school that is accredited by the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges. The Northwest Association of Accredited Schools, NAES as it's known, is now accrediting non-degree post-secondary proprietary schools. We feel that NAES accreditation does not provide any greater assurance to the state or students than other accrediting agencies, and we suggest that the language referencing NAES be omitted. In Section 5C, the change would require fingerprinting and subsequent criminal background checks on individuals within a school that that will be or does enroll students under the age 18. We wholeheartedly support this provision. We believe underage students must be protected, and we must help ensure that they're safe. We suggest that any school, public or private, that sends representatives into high school for career days, we have representing agents that go into the high schools. We want to make sure that those for recruiting purposes must demonstrate that those recruiters have undergone background checks. Mm-hmm. So we would even like to extend it just a little bit further. The bill does not mention the frequency of conducting the background searches for these individuals. While we suggest that every 3 years is reasonable, we look forward to working with the agency staff to arrive at the appropriate frequency and cost to implement this safety requirement. Again, thank you for allowing me to comment before you today and considering the amendments and the comments that we've made. Thank you.
Thank you. And I trust that with the amendments now in hand that you'll be able to work together, and
yes,
we'll bring this back once you've had the opportunity to hammer out all the details, hopefully not in the car.
Yes.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Representative Dimbrough?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And welcome, Kathy and Alan. Alan, thank you for the magnet. I have to tell you that until 2 weeks ago, this was up on my refrigerator, and then it came down. And it came down for one reason, because our refrigerator needed to be replaced, stopped working. And the new one doesn't hold magnets, and it's really frustrating, because I love this magnet. anyway, welcome. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the tuition protection aspect of and I mean, why tuition protection is needed for the, you know, the license, the students, you know, under the licensure, ODE licensure, and then they're not needed once they're moving to degree status?
I can't speak to the what ODE does and what their rules and standards are because we don't work with those. I certainly would ask Department of Ed if they want to come on back up with the chair's indulgence. I'm not sure how you want to do that, but our office handles the situation a little differently. We require degree-granting institutions to either demonstrate that they have sufficient cash reserves to make a 100% refund for the current term that any student might be enrolled in, or that they post a bond to cover that. We don't maintain a fund that the schools pay into, that the state manages, but we require that they demonstrate that to us during their application and renewal process. In our case, the renewal term runs either 2, 3, or 4 years, depending largely on our assessment of the stability of the institution. So we address the issue, we just do it through a different mechanism. One of the reasons for that is that degree-granting schools typically operate on a term or quarter or semester system, and once you have finished that quarter or semester, you have earned the credits for it. Those are transcriptable, and you may use those forever. Therefore, there's no refund that would be needed for that because you have already earned those. Most career schools don't work that way. You're in a program. You pay a fee for an entire program or for very large chunks of it. Therefore, if you leave the program at some point during that process, you don't go out of there with transferable credits. But any further questions about the way the Department of Ed one works should probably be addressed to them.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can I follow up? Yeah, actually, I am more interested in the protections, you know, once they get to your status. And so your explanation of the bond and the analysis of, you know, finishing out the quarter or semester really helps. Have there been instances where schools, where, you know, let's say, you know, a student has entered a program and is, you know, looking to get a degree, the school ceases, they can then go on to another school, but they have problems transferring those credits, or, you know, there are just challenges, and they find themselves in a situation where, in effect, they have invested in a career path, and then they find themselves having to start over again.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Denbrough. I don't believe I reintroduced myself when I'm answering. I'm Alan Contreras from Degree Authorization. We do come across that situation. It doesn't happen very often. It is happening right now in Portland because Cascade College is closing, and they are arranging for a teach-out arrangement through which their students can complete elsewhere. For them, that's relatively straightforward because they are a regionally accredited institution. They are a branch of Oklahoma Christian University. If you attend a regionally accredited institution, the transfer of credits from here to there is generally fairly straightforward. Not everything will transfer because there are certain programs that have certain requirements. If you attend a school that has specialized accreditation but not regional accreditation, your ability to transfer credits is going to be more limited. It might be possible for you to transfer some, but certainly not all. The reason for this is driven largely by the regulations and expectations of the various accrediting bodies. It is generally not something that is in law, state or federal. It is simply the way U.S. accreditation has grown up, and it's fairly controversial. There's a lot of noise at the federal level in recent years about some kind of arrangement through which credits would be more easily transferable. One of the reasons they are not is that there are some structural differences in the way that courses are done. Most career schools keep track of coursework on a clock hour system, for example, instead of a credit hour system. So there's not an innate way of transferring things across without some sort of conversion process. And then, of course, there's a certain amount of territorial protection by everybody. Finally, there are unaccredited schools. The acceptance of credits from those is generally much more difficult. Some of those do have state approval through our office, and our Gutenberg and Eugene is a good example of a reputable unaccredited school. It's a great books college. It only has about 40 students. Because they are state approved, they have veterans eligibility, but the transfer of credits is still going to be very difficult. And going back to something that Representative Huffman mentioned earlier, he was talking about the importance of getting a lot of diplomas into the workplace and the economy. Our job is to make sure that those are real diplomas and not fake diplomas, and that screening function is something we do with the unaccredited schools.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much. Are there any last questions? We still have one more bill today to hear.
This will be very short.
Norman?
First, very clever. Very clever. I did not know about your department, but I will not forget it now. But this is for Kathy. Thank you for your comments about criminal record checks. I do agree with you that there does need to be a system in place and frequency, so I encourage you to look at the Employment Division Child Care Division of the Employment Division, because they already have policies in place that do criminal history checks.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to thank you both very much, and I will be in touch with you as you are in touch with each other. I hope we can move this bill forward in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. And Kevin will follow up, too. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2108 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2109. Kevin, can you give us a quick overview of House Bill 2509?
Madam Chair.
2109. We're done with 2509. House Bill 2109.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you HB House Bill 2109. As I understand it, this is largely a technical change, and it changes essentially through a number of different statutes, a varied number of statutes, terms professional technical education and professional technical training to career and technical education and career and technical training. The primary impetus behind this is to confirm, as I understand, state law with federal law. And I understand the Department of Education is here. We do have, that's the information with respect to the bill.
Thank you. Morgan, please. And Kathy McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and members of the committee. For your record, again, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And although the bill, I believe, is 15 pages and may look like it has a lot to it, it really is the prototypical textbook technical change bill for this session from the Department of Education. Just to give you a little bit of background, the Carl D. Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act was first authorized by Congress in 1984, and it aims to increase the quality of technical education in public schools. During the current biennium, community colleges and K-12 institutions in Oregon receive about $30 million in Perkins grant funds. And in 2006, the act was renamed and reauthorized as the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Improvement Act of 2006. A major component of that change in 2006 was a change in terminology. Terms like career and technical education were put in place of terms like vocational education, and that federal act extends through 2013. So with House Bill 2109, what the department is attempting to do is make technical cleanup changes to reflect this updated federal terminology. So just to give you a couple examples, throughout the bills you'll see the terms professional technical education and professional technical training have been changed to career and technical education and career and technical training, respectively, throughout the bill, and that conforms with federal law. So the professional organizations for career and technical education have made these changes, and school districts and community colleges are in the process of making these changes, and 2109 will bring our statutes in line with the Federal Perkins Act.
So to summarize, it's a technical change to change the word to technical?
Chair Gelser, that is technically correct.
Right, thank you. Just didn't want to get hung up on the technicalities.
Oh,
no. Kathy. She's quick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Kathy McDonald, and I represent Northwest Career College Federation. I come before you in support of House Bill 2109. Private career colleges have a heritage that is strong as the history of career education evolved from business schools to trade schools, then to vocational programs, and finally career and technical education. It shows that the value of career education has proven to be vital to the higher education sector. It is amazing and rewarding to private career educators to think that what was established over 165 years ago is now expanded to many sectors, serving thousands of students in private career and community colleges and universities, which offer certificates, associates, bachelor's degrees, master's, and doctoral degrees in career and technical fields. Here in Oregon, our degree-granting colleges educate over 7,700 students annually in specific career and technical fields. Career schools focus on educating tomorrow's workforce. We are proud of the role that we play in meeting the governor's 40-40-20 goal. We appreciate Superintendent Castillo's proposed change to meet current terminology reflective of today's education and workplace needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Roblin?
So, are they actually putting money in the reauthorization of the properties? I mean, I don't want to change this if there isn't something going with it, because
Chair
we
Gelser,
almost lost it.
Chair Gelser and Representative Roblin, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that during the current biennium, community colleges and K-12 get about $30 million in Perkins grants that get distributed out to programs. A bit of trivia, Carl Perkins, federal Perkins loans he was a Kentucky congressman, apparently very big on education. So lots of programs and things named after him.
Yep.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, this is a fairly simple bill, and if you all are comfortable, we can move the bill today, or we can bring it back later. I would like to move it today just for the sake of efficiency.
Technically, I think that would be a good idea.
That technically be all right? Are people comfortable with that? All right. Seeing no objection, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2109. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2109. Kevin, we do have the fiscal and revenue impact statements.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the revenue and fiscal statements are before you at the dais. And there's no fiscal impact or revenue impact perspectives.
Thank you. Does anybody have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough moves House Bill 2109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I thought I'd get you here.
Seeing none, is there any objection?
Not too well, but I know.
If there's no objection, do we have to call the roll? Seeing none, so passed.
Okay. Could we put it on the consent agenda?
And that was coming next.
Oh, okay.
so passed. Is there any objection to putting this bill on the consent agenda? Now, I want to make sure nobody was staying up last night because they really wanted to carry it. And all right.
Okay.
All right. Well, except for Representative Roblin. So this will go to the consent agenda. And closing the work session on House Bill 2109 and adjourning the House Committee on Education. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.